Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talks and Tales, your weekly insights into zoos and aquariums. You are joined by Tess and Daisy. How are you, Daisy?
Hello. Hi, everyone. I am good. Thank you, Tess. Nothing hugely to report from me this week, but I did have a little bit of a recommendation. At the very start of when Tess and I started recording podcasts, we had the pleasure of interviewing Eliza. Eliza does a lot of stuff in the field. She works pretty closely with wombats, but she also is the face behind Women in Wildlife, which is an Instagram page and a community all about sort of providing opportunities and highlighting the opportunities and what women are doing in wildlife. They have a really interesting Instagram page where they share and highlight a lot of different people around the world. But recently they have touched on compassion fatigue and imposter syndrome. And they are a couple of things that Tess and I have maybe dabbled in talking about, but they explain it really well and some really beautiful points that they make. So if that's something that you have ever found yourself struggling with or are thinking about sort of looking a little bit more into, then I would definitely recommend heading to women.in.wildlife and having a look at that.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion and definitely something that we'd like to delve further into at some stage on Trainer Talks and Tales as well.
Yeah, absolutely. How are you?
Yeah, I was going to say not much for me, Days. A lot's happening not here at home. But I would just like to wish everyone all the best for the conference, the ASZK conference, which is happening this weekend in Perth. There's a lot of Trainer Talks and Tales fans heading over there, so all the best if you're presenting or just going to enjoy the conference, and we can't wait to hear everything that's been spoken about, and hopefully we'll have a couple of those topics on the podcast as well when we come back. So looking forward to that, but let's get into this episode. Did you want to introduce our guest today, Daisy?
Yeah, absolutely. So today we are lucky enough to be joined by Sophie. Sophie is joining us all the way from the UK. She spent a lot of her early career working within zoos and then has transitioned into conservation, and with that conservation, primarily working with rhinos in Africa. So she really touches on sort of what a day in the life might look like. We talk a little bit about, you know, the conservation goals, the problems that rhinos are facing, what she gets up to in aiding with those rhinos. And then we also touch a little bit about on sort of getting lost with the word zookeeper as your personality and, you know, what the future can look like, and a real variety of different topics. So I found it was a really interesting episode and something a little bit different to what we've done in the past. So we really hope that you guys enjoy it, because we definitely did.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Sophie, thank you so much for joining Tess and I on Trainer Talks and Tales today. We are so excited to chat all about rhinos and conservation.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, for sure. Now, obviously, before we get started, we'd like to have a little bit of fun. And so we'll dive straight into our fast five, if that works for you.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Question number one, vultures or puffins?
Oh, no. Oh, no. You've been so mean with these questions. vultures.
Okay. Cake or cookies?
Oh, I'm allergic to both, but cookies.
Apples or oranges?
Probably apples.
Favorite reptile?
Probably a water monitor or like a really impressive snake, like a black mamba or something.
Okay, and final question, great gray owls or burrowing owls?
Great gray.
I threw a couple of hard ones at you, so it's like they a new are. Struggle. Well, like I said, Tess and I are so excited to chat to you, Sophie. Me and you actually met a few years ago when I was back home in England, and I came up to the Hawks Conservancy Trust, which was where I had the absolute pleasure of meeting a little tiny burrowing owl for the first time, which was just literally one of the biggest highlights ever. It was so much fun.
Super cool. Super
cool. Yeah, I definitely recommend anyone visiting that place if you're ever in the UK, because it's such a cool spot. But do you mind maybe starting off today by just sharing a little bit more about your career that started within the zoo industry?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny you mentioned the Hawks. I was there last week. I still like pop in and help them with different things. So I was there doing some experience days with them. Well, I've done a few since I've been home, so I'm back in the UK now. But most people, I didn't really. I feel like there's not really a normal route into the zoo industry. Like everyone has some kind of crazy story as to how they ended up there. When I jumped into the industry, so I was still at uni when I officially was started the industry. And looking back, I have absolutely no idea how I used to manage my hours. So, other than a few bits of work experience, I started volunteering at my local zoo and also the Hawk Conservancy. I was doing kind of every spare day I had between uni, I'd be volunteering. And then I started volunteering as a hoofstock volunteer, so all your ungulates. And then that eventually, so this was in 2017, that eventually became a kind of like a summer position. I had like multiple contracts across my local zoo, which was I started hoofstock and then almost ironically, so when I started, like giraffes were like the best thing ever, and then I met a rhino and my whole world changed. I did hoofstock for the first few contracts, and then I got offered the chance to go and cover some positions on carnivores. And my time at the zoo, actually, the majority of my paid work was as a co assistant carnivore keeper. It's quite an interesting one because I was kind of across multiple contracts over from 2017 to 2021, and then in 2020, late 2021, I got the opportunity to go to Africa, and then yeah, that's where all of that
The rest is
conservation field
history.
ended up. Yeah,
Do
basically.
you mind just kind of touching on a little bit, because it's very different in the UK as it is to Australia majority of the time. I guess if I'm correct, please correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a long time since I've worked over there. A lot of the facilities are not open or run very short staffed over the winter periods, so that you end up having a lot more summer seasonal positions. So that's what you're talking about when you're referring to those casual contracts. It's like
Yeah,
for the busy
so
times.
yeah, basically. So my facility was open all year, but there's definitely like a huge change in the amount of people you see over the winter compared to the summer. So like you said, there are places that your summer season kind of starts kind of now, May, and then you'll work through till October, November, sometimes even January, depends when they want you. So a lot of people starting in the industry, they will go for these seasonal roles. Mine was kind of a bit different. They were kind of seasonal, but I, in between COVID and everything that was going on, they kind of just kept offering me contracts. Mine was slightly different, but yeah, the seasonal contracts, it's very useful for people that want to start somewhere. And I think a lot of them can be aimed more towards people who don't necessarily have the experience of a keeper that's been working for 2 years already.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, following that, you obviously have worked with a lot of different species and a lot of
Yeah.
different places. And you mentioned that you ended up in Africa as you were offered a short-term contract at a rhino orphanage. Was field work something that you were always interested in?
I don't think it ever crossed my mind that it was a possibility for me to do. It was always one of, I mean, anyone going into the industry, like the ultimate is, well, I can't speak for everyone, but to work with your species in the wild is a huge goal for a lot of people. It wasn't necessarily the direction I thought I'd go in. I really thought I'd be one of these people that would be in the zoo for many years of my life in the same place, but it just didn't turn out like that. And I am a bit of a risk taker, but at the time I got offered my contract, it gets exhausting being in those contracts that aren't permanent. It does become exhausting. And the time I was offered my position in South Africa, I was very much looking back, I was almost at burnout. And it was time for me to reach a place where I needed to realized that I was more capable than I was being told I was because of my position, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really good to be able to look back and realize that, you know, possibly burnout was something that you were struggling with. And it's always great to be able to reflect in the moment. But I'd say for majority of people, just like you said, it's something that in hindsight, you're a little bit more aware of. Can you possibly share a little bit more about what the sort of organization was that you worked for in South Africa and what their sort of conservation goals were primarily based around?
When I got offered the position, it was kind of like a long-term volunteer role, but it was one that turned into, like, we were such a small team that we were essentially staff members. It was many years of being persistent on emails. I think when I looked back through my emails and through my messages with some of the people I met there, I'd been messaging them many, many years prior to see if I could come out for a few weeks. It was 3 months that turned into the best part of a year, basically. But the role is, it's as you imagine, it's very, very tough. It's one of these times in my life where I realized how much I've learned from being a zookeeper. You have so many skill sets that are so niche. So you're basically the nutritionist, the behaviorist, the vet nurse, the cleaner, everything. And the environment we went into in the orphanage was all of that, but almost like intensely, because you've got another level of these animals aren't used to people. They're traumatized. They've seen stuff that no people should ever see, no animal should ever see. So the behavior of the animals were very, very different. So the facility itself is a rhino orphanage. So essentially what happens, there's a lot of cases where mum's pregnant or mum's got a young and they won't kill the babies. They leave the babies to fend for themselves. Sometimes they do, if the babies are in the way, it was quite often that they would come in with severe injuries from gunshots, machetes, whatever has been used to poach mum. So the facility was based around, we're the second chance at that. You essentially become mum. It's a very hard concept to grasp, because as an animal keeper from the UK particularly, it's very protected contact, whereas you're suddenly thrown into a position where you're the support for that young rhino until it's an adult, basically. So the facility itself, the youngest rhino I worked with was 4 weeks when I met him. He actually came in while I was on a visa run back in the UK, and I was sat here eagerly like, I need to get back, I need to help you. And then the older rhinos were fully adults out on reserve. So yeah, that's kind of the premise of the facility, is to give them a second chance where they don't have. And every rhino's life is so important. And one of the things that struck me most is that, like, those statistics that you talk about at the zoo, you do however many keeper talks a day, it doesn't matter what species, but rhinos, your statistics roll out, rhinos are being poached every 9 hours, 12 hours, and it's suddenly not a statistic anymore, it's right in front of you. And it's very, very hard hitting the disconnect from what you're saying to what's actually happening, are like worlds apart.
Yeah, and I can imagine what you were saying. It's very different for a keeper to be surrounded by animals that are just so well looked after, have been surrounded by people the moment they've, you know, been born. And so to see firsthand these animals that have been through so much trauma and basically then just absolutely turning their life around must have been pretty hectic. And kudos to you for being part of that. Can you give us a little bit more of an insight of, like, what a day or a week in the life there would look like?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. You see all kinds of trauma that you didn't even realize animals could have. But yeah, a day in the life, this is going to sound absolutely mental to you, but we essentially worked, we were on shift for like 24 hour So you'd work 24 hours and then you'd be off for 24 hours and vice versa. It was insane, as you can imagine, but with babies like this, it was round the clock care. We had, for example, that youngster that came in, he couldn't be on his own. Ideally you'd put rhinos with rhinos as soon as possible. They'll learn better off of each other, even if they're like tiny, a few meters high, than they will off of any human interaction. So in an ideal world, that's what happened. But in a lot of cases, they're severely compromised. They're severely ill. They've got a lot of problems. They need milk every 2 hours. They might have really, really sensitive stomachs. So even like the slight change in milk or in giving them used to the milk can give them like severe diarrhea. It's not a nice thing. And so the day can change very much depending on what individuals you have in, how old they are, what needs they have. We had a lot of a lot of milk. I actually have it here somewhere. I think my whole time there, I recorded every bottle of milk I made to the day that I left, and it was in excess of 700 easily. And that's just one person. We were a team of six, pretty much. So yeah, that's just one person in like under a year. So you can imagine how much milk gets made. But typically it's like, get up, say you are on a day shift, it's like the first milk's at six, you'd do all the milks. We were actually very lucky that we had some workers there that did a lot of our cleaning for us in the big Boma areas, and they were absolutely fantastic, like excellent at what they did. But all of the kitchen areas, the little night rooms we had for the youngsters, we all had to clean them ourselves. It's kind of hard to say what what a typical day has, but yeah, milk every 2-3 hours. You've got to go in and feed the older rhinos with supplements of grass. And we also gave pellets because there was not enough grass in the area they had because it was winter. The cycles would go pretty much based around milk. You always had your milk alarms on all day and all night. And we had to do things like packing grass. We could go out with the rhino monitor, who would go out to the rhinos on reserve, and it was basically her job to see them every day, make sure they're all good. It's essentially like being a zookeeper in the fact that you go in, do your husbandry, your cleaning, your feeding, but the feeding's constant. You've got lots of animal washing, everything that you'd expect for a typical rescue rehab, basically. But you also have this level of responsibility that you are now mum, and you have to essentially teach the rhinos as best as you can how to be a rhino. Obviously, like I said, they teach each other, but this would involve things like taking them on a walk into the bush and letting them explore a bit, and encouraging, if they were well enough, to run, to wallow in the mud, teaching them what the mud was, like all things that mum would show them, even to the point of teaching them. The weaning process is quite slow with rhinos, but even like encouraging them to go near the grass and sniff the grass, or getting them to watch other animals eating the grass. So it was kind of like an individual basis, but there's a lot of factors, because at any moment your day could go from your typical normal, in quotation marks, normal day to suddenly you've got an orphan that's coming in by helicopter, or an orphan 4 hours away that you have to go and pick up. So it goes from like, I don't want to say calm, but manageable to unmanageable very quickly.
Oh, it's so interesting hearing all about it. And what an incredible work that all these organizations are doing. And I really loved how you said about the fact that, you know, we talk about, I think probably everyone who works in the industry is like, no day is the same, every day is different. And when we're talking about that, we're talking about like oh, we might do enrichment in the morning, or we might do a training session in the afternoon, or the next day we might do enrichment in the midday. Like, I think when you're talking about what you're doing though, it's so insanely different. And I think you have to be a particular type of person that can be very adaptable to change, and being okay with being open to, you know, seeing a lot of trauma, like you mentioned, and changing exactly what the animals are requiring from you that day. And that, you know, that's a hard job, I can imagine. How many sort of rhinos would you have on average under your care at any time?
I can't really like say in total because for the safety of the rhinos, but it really depended. Like, we had like what we called like milk babies. They were the ones still on milk, so they'd take milk until they're 18, a year to 18 months old. The 4 week old one was every 2 hours, like 3 a.m. you're up making milk. I think the most I had as milk babies was about 6 different milk babies. It's challenging, but luckily we have like a really nice big board with everything on. But you have like a million different alarms set, because one is one rhino's got milk here, but the others don't have milk here, and then it's just really.
It sounds really hectic, but six baby rhino mouths is a lot, but like adorable as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like you really have those moments of like, wow, like they're so cute. And I hate to be that person that's like, oh, they're really cute, but when you've got like a baby rhino that's chasing you through the bush and it's having, you can like see the joy, and you can see its development, especially over like months of being there. It's so rewarding in a different way, because you've also seen their trauma, and you and when I say trauma, that it can be anything from loud bangs remind them of a gunshot, or you're middle of the night looking after a baby, because one of them had fled the baby. He had to be 24 hours, and he just has like vivid dreams. When you see those little glimmers of them just being a rhino, that's when you're really like, they're cute, but you're also every day hit with why they're actually there. So it's always like hindered by I wish you weren't here, but you are cute.
you are cute. You can only be human to say they are adorable. And you know, like you said, there's no world in which any animal should ever have to go through pain or trauma like that. What has kind of been the biggest takeaway for you, and how do you think that we could maybe ensure that important information is being passed on to everyone?
I think it's like talking about it's important. It's one of those roles I've had where the only people that really understand those feelings of what it was like to care for baby rhinos are the people who were in it with you, or the people who work at other facilities that are doing the same. One thing that sticks with us all is it's now our responsibility to tell the stories. And when you meet such charismatic individuals that have thrived, they've gone from like you really like on death's door to they're now living out there with other rhinos, perfectly normal, normal rhino life. It really hits home that you can't stop telling people about why they were there, what they did. And I think that's the first step of really spreading the message. And over my years in Africa, I think this is something that's really hit home recently as well, is there's so much going on that isn't being portrayed in Western media compared to what's actually happening on the ground. And it's not just rescue rehab, it's across the board in different organizations, and I've dipped into a few of them. So I think it's really like talking to the individuals that do work there. Are we portraying the conservation world properly to the level that it needs to be for people to understand that the statistics aren't just statistics?
Yeah, I think that you mentioned that really well before by saying it's one thing to say like in your talk, like, oh, this happens all the time, da da da, this, and people are like, oh, yep. But for you to see it firsthand and see the effects and wanna share that message is very important, and it makes sense that only the people who have seen it can really resonate with how basically hectic it is and how much it's impacting those animals. So with that, do you feel personally that you struggle with knowing where you want to go in terms of your career, like being a zookeeper in a safe facility taking care of these animals, or do you feel like you should head back into field work and go back into rhino conservation?
I'm always very open to being where I'm needed, but I think the animal industry as a whole, it does make it difficult, because seeing as much wild as I have seen, it's very difficult to relate this like intensity of it to the general public without being too like in your face and yeah basically. And I think it is a struggle to kind of find my place, but the more people you meet and the more you do it, I should rephrase that, the more you do it, the more people you meet who are doing the same thing. There's so many people across the industry in conservation who are in one place and then in another place. And I think it comes from that. You want to be helping somewhere. There's this misconception of you have to be where you are always, whereas it's very normal for particularly conservationists to feel lost, to feel a bit out of it. I think especially coming from a zoo background, you're in such like a tight-knit team at a zoo, your role is equally as important.
I think, Sophie, that you answered that really well, and I'm sure that, you know, at some point within everyone's career within the industry, that they have felt just how overwhelming that it can be for, you know, every single person. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced, I guess, the word zookeeper, or, you know, what you do as a job, feeling like it is encompassing your whole personality? And if so, like, have you, you know, used any tools that help sort of remove that? Not completely, but, you know, elements of it.
I think I mentioned before, like, when I left my zoo position, I pretty much, in hindsight, I think I was at burnout. At the time, I couldn't see it. It probably didn't help going into, like, such traumatic work afterwards. But anyway, that's a different story. But I think it's easy to become, like, engrossed by the whole personality of being a zookeeper and being a conservationist. Because you do see those animals more than your families and more than your friends, especially like conservation work. I think it's quite easy to get lost because you are so far and you live really remotely from anyone, so you see the same six people every day for literally months on end, which as you can imagine is challenging in itself at times. It's very easy to feel like you're not doing enough because your everyday becomes your everyday. And it's the same in conservation roles. Like, you're there with all of these rhinos and you still feel like it's not enough. The more you do it, the more people you meet that are also doing the same thing. And I wrote a little note down here. Is one thing that someone said to me when I left the zoo, because I nearly didn't go. Can you believe that? Like, this huge opportunity to go and work with rhinos in the wild. Like, I nearly didn't go because I love zoo life. Like, it's amazing in itself, and getting to work that closely with animals is very rewarding. I wrote it down so I didn't forget it. But when I left, there was always this like reminder to myself that the zoo's always going to be there. And what was said to me is that no matter what you do, you can never undo what you've always done. and always have done. And whether it's a few months or a few years that you decide to take a break or go anywhere, the experience you have or have wherever you are in conservation or a zoo, for example, is always and will always be your experience. Like, no one can ever say you never did that, because you always did. That really stuck with me when I left the zoo, because I was always like, oh, what if I can never like work in the zoo again? And like, even now I would like, if the opportunity was there, I would still go back and do it. That's one thing that was said to me that really, really stuck with me. So it's easy to feel like you're encompassed by your personality of zookeeper, but you're so much more than that. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but the zoo industry in the UK can be quite gatekeepy, and I find that really challenges a lot of people in the fact that they feel like they have to fit in a certain box to be able to do something. In particularly Africa, Southern Africa, it's not as gatekeepy. It's very like networking is a huge like key to most zoo jobs, most conservation jobs. Talking to people about your experiences can really help you with a lot of things, but there's also a lot of people that are very willing to bring you on board. Over time, I've learned that you really don't have to feel like your whole being has to be your role as such. It has to be the message that you want to portray, because the biggest part of the work we do, whether you're a zoo conservationist, is teaching people about what's happening so that they can. And as long as someone cares from what you've done, then I'd say you're doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. No, it does. And the quote that you shared, I think, is beautiful. Like, I've never heard that before, but I actually resonate to that a lot. And I think a lot of people probably will. And I think, kind of touching on what you spoke about, you know, as humans, we're natural empaths. We want to be compassionate. We give a lot of passion and time and energy to what we do as animal carers. You know, we are spending so much time with these animals, and it can be incredibly overwhelming. It can be very easy to take it home with us, which might be different to people working in different industries, different fields. But I think, like you said, you know, if you leave the industry, it's not like your brain changes from, I want to help protect and conserve animals. Like, okay, well, I've left the industry and I no longer want to do that anymore. Like, you know, we speak about it all the time, 99% of people doing this job do it because they are so incredibly passionate, and majority of us did it for free for years. And, you know, you absolutely understand that, you know, Tess and I both volunteered. So yeah, I think you really touched on that really well, and different ways that we can maybe remind ourselves that it's okay. That's not our own personality. We still can stand by what we believe in, and we can still give everything to it when we need to, but we can also take some time out to think about other things that makes us who we are too.
Yeah. And I think it's important to like almost like team up with other people in your industry to talk about it. And there's a really good blog. I don't know if you follow the Lonely Conservationists on Instagram, but if you go check it out, she actually wrote a book, but she writes like regular vlogs. And I think there's a lot of people in that community that resonate with it, because it's all kind of field stuff that people have experienced. And when you're in these positions that are really remote as well, it's easy to feel like you're in it on your own when you're not. When you start reading other people's blogs or other people's accounts, you realize you face your facilities, the work you might be doing is slightly different, whether in the field or the zoo industry, but you still have faced the same challenges, and you still have people that you might not know, but you very much can resonate with on the same level, in terms of how isolating it can be to work in these fields, or how easy it can be to be consumed by your work. And like I said, as much as we love our animals, we love our jobs, it's very important to have that like separation in some way.
Absolutely. Well said. Well, we always like to end our episodes with a question from our listener. And I think our listener, just the one. No, we've got many.
Hello out there.
Just my mum, no. Our final question to you was from a listener, and it's a great one. How can we best support rhino conservation besides just donating money or being in Africa? Are there other options?
Again, it goes back to talking about it, talking about what's happening. And that is a huge push right now. And I think particularly with rhinos, like, you've got your five species of rhinos, and there's a lot of confusion within the field. So even like reading up about what's happening in different areas is very important. For example, like the northern white rhinos, what's going on with them compared to the southern white rhinos are completely different. Whereas I think there's a lot of blend there where people think that's the same situation when it's not. And I saw a post the other day about I think it was the Javan rhinos, where they were saying 10% of their population has been poached in the last, since 2019, I think the report said. Which people were sharing around, but the severity of that still isn't quite connected, that it's 10% of the population, but the population of Javan rhinos is like 75 individuals. So that's mega compared to, obviously, losing 10% of any population is mega, but resources of reading, I've got a million books you can read about rhinos. There's a really good documentary called, it's actually a South African one called, I will warn you, it's very graphic. It's called Stroop, but it's a documentary that really shows you the ins and outs of rhino conservation and what's going on in every area, because it's easy to place blame on certain parts of the world because there's a demand in Southeast Asia for the rhino horn. So it's easy to be like, the blame is here, when that's not true at all. The whole rhino poaching scene is organized crime. It's the same as like your whole anything, like any huge organized criminal organizations where you've got your kingpin at the top and it works the way down. It's not just poor people who are taking advantage. There's definitely is some of that, but it's a lot more complex than what people realize. And a really good way that was put to me once is, a lot of it stems from belief. Rhino horn, it's a belief, and it's not something that's just going to change by telling people it's wrong. It's much bigger than that. So I think in terms of like what you can do is honestly, like, if you want a list like of books or documentaries, I can give you some, but read about it, learn about it more, so you can tell more people about what's actually going on, rather than just being like, oh, the rhinos are being poached, we should save them. Because it's a lot more in depth than just that.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I even feel more informed by having this chat with you. It's out of sight, out of mind, isn't it? If you
absolutely
don't have it in your Instagram feed, or if you don't read articles about it, you don't think about it. So in having this conversation, it's a step in the right direction, because hopefully a lot of our listeners have thought about it as well. And just spreading that word and spreading that conservation message, absolutely. So we really appreciate that. I think you've done such a wonderful job of you know, obviously hitting those hard questions, but
yeah, sorry, it was a bit depressing.
So, we really do appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think sometimes it can be really overwhelming to think about all the things that you need to do to try and help save an animal, and it's just, some of those things are just way out of the reach of certain people. So to be able to learn and share, and just, you know, something that you can just have a conversation about every day, is something that seems very manageable and very easy for people to do in comparison to volunteering their time overseas. But you know, like that is obviously the goal and some incredible work that you're participating in, and the conservation programs we are all obviously so incredibly grateful for.
We have to share more what's happening rather than just blindsiding it to facts and figures in statistics and books that we share, because the more you know, then the more, it's like a butterfly effect, really.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Sophie. We are so incredibly grateful to have you on. And it's been nice talking about something a little bit different for us at Training Talks. And thinking a lot of people was going to actually really enjoy listening to this episode too.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for letting me share some of my stories. And thank you.
I found that to be really interesting, Daisy. It's a little bit different to what we've usually spoken about. And as we said in the episode, it's very different when you're relaying this information to the audience or to the public and having these stats and figures, but to have seen it firsthand is just remarkable. And I guess that's our role as keepers, to basically bring this to the forefront of the people's minds without being too heavy and really pushing that conservation message across, because at the end of the day, there's a lot happening on the other side of the world that we don't know about. So people need to be educated for sure. Did you enjoy the episode too, Dace?
Yeah, no, I think you said that beautifully, Tess. I really enjoyed it. And to sort of participate in some conservation is definitely something that I would like to achieve in the next sort of 5 years or so. And I really push, you know, everyone else as well to get out there and see what we can do out in the field and how that can help impact those species as well, whether it's in Africa or whether it's in Australia or your, you know, back door, whatever it is. So yeah, I love that episode and we hope you guys did too. But that is us wrapping up from now. We'll be back in your ears next week.
See you next week.
Bye.